We're about to announce the secret surprise volunteer for the panel, and it's going to be one of the people that are still standing in the back of the room.
I think we ought to let Ed do it as a swan song.
Well, interesting you should mention Ed. Actually, a very interesting question, I think, came up in this morning's discussion, which is, why are people so reluctant to agree with Ed Trott? I can't help but ribbing Ed just a little bit here. I just wanted to recognize this is Ed's last meeting at the SAG as the FASB's official observer, and just wanted to extend my thanks for his participation and input over the past couple of years. Thanks a lot, Ed.
Just let me say, I've enjoyed it, but I've got to leave here in a few minutes to go meet with 40 bankers who are just agreeing with everything I say.
With that, I'll turn the floor over to Bella Rivshin. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Our next topic for the panel discussion will focus on whether more direction should be included in the board's auditing and related professional practice standards about which members of the engagement team are responsible for performing the auditing procedures during an audit engagement. Today's panel discussion will specifically focus on two aspects of the audit, the planning and supervision of the audit engagements, and the areas of the audit that are higher risk or that involve complex issues or an extensive use of professional judgment. The PCAOB interim auditing standards provide direction on how to conduct an audit and perform applicable auditing procedures. The standards, however, do not specifically provide direction as to which members of the engagement team have the responsibility to perform the auditing procedures. In general, the auditing standards provide high-level direction to the audit partner for the planning and supervision of an audit engagement and include a general discussion about technical training and proficiency of the independent auditor. The standards rely on judgment of the audit partner to properly plan and supervise the audit engagement. The auditing standards state that the work performed on an audit engagement is to be adequately planned and supervised, and the engagement team members, if any, are to be properly supervised. The auditing standards also state that the auditor should be assigned to tasks and supervised commensurate with their level of knowledge, skill, and ability so they can evaluate the audit evidence that they are examining. The auditing standards classify the auditors as either the auditor with final responsibility for the audit, typically the audit partner, or assistants, basically everyone else on the engagement team. Although the auditing standards state that the audit partner is responsible for the assignment of tasks and to and the supervision of the engagement team members, in general, the auditing standards do not assign the specific responsibility to the audit partner for the planning and supervision of the audit. The standards also state that the audit partner may delegate portions of the planning and supervision of the audit to other firm personnel without limiting the extent or the portions of the audit planning and supervision that may so be delegated. In contrast, the International Standard on Auditing describes the engagement partner's responsibilities in a bit greater detail. The PCAOB interim auditing standards related to planning the engagement directs the auditor and does not assign the audit partner any specific procedures and responsibilities as to the planning of the audit. With respect to supervision, although the auditing standards require their work to be performed by each engagement team member to be reviewed to determine whether it is adequately performed and to evaluate whether the results are consistent with the conclusions to be presented in the auditor's report, the standard doesn't specify who is required to perform that review. As it relates to performing the audits, the standards in general do not specify which member of the team should perform the auditing procedures relating to the key risk areas of the audit, such as risk assessment, fraud risk analysis, and other aspects of the audit that involve the analysis of complex issues or the extensive use of professional judgment. Rather, the auditing standards in most instances direct the auditor to perform the auditing procedure versus directing the actual audit partner or another member of the engagement team to perform those procedures. In contrast, the PCAOB interim quality control standards provide specific direction to the concurring partner reviewer regarding his or her responsibilities on an audit engagement. The board's interim quality control standards state that the concurring partner fulfills his or her responsibility by, among other things, discussing significant accounting, auditing, and financial reporting matters with the audit engagement partner in reviewing applicable documentation relating to the resolution of the matters, discussing the audit engagement team's identification and the audit of high-risk transactions and account balances, reviewing the summary of unadjusted differences, and reading the financial statements and the auditor's report. Although the quality control standards outline the minimum procedures the recurring partner is responsible for performing, the auditing standards do not have a similar list of specific audit procedures that the audit partner is required to perform on the audit engagements. The PCAOB invited Bill Messier and Mark Peacher to discuss the partner's involvement during the planning and the supervision of the audit engagement and also in the higher risk areas of the audit and areas that involve high complex issues and extensive use of professional judgment. Mr. Messier is a professor of accountancy at Georgia State University, and Mark Peacher is a professor of accountancy at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Unfortunately, because Mark could not be here today, Bill will also present Mark's prepared remarks on his behalf, which will be followed by an open dialogue among SAG members, observers, panelists, and the PCAOB. With that, I think we're ready to begin, and I will turn it over for Bill for his remarks and Mark's remarks.
Too much high tech here. First of all, Mark and I would like to thank the PCAOB for giving us the opportunity to share our comments with you about this issue. And on a personal level, it's really nice for me to see some of my old friends from my days on the board and other committees, in particular. The question that's on the table is, should auditing standards provide specific guidance as to which members of the audit team should have responsibilities for certain audit procedures? And when Mark and I talked about this, we decided to sort of divvy up the discussion, and I'm sort of going to take more of the standard-setting side, and Mark's comments, which I'll present to you in a minute, talk to some of the research that may shed some light on this issue. And both Mark and I have contributed in this area in terms of the research area. It seems to me when you look at this, who should do what on the audit, you can look at this at two levels. One level is what I call the high level, which goes beyond just the two topics that are on the agenda today, and that's the question of just how prescriptive should auditing standards be. And this is not the first time I've had to address this. Tom was the one who got me appointed to the International Auditing Standards Subcommittee, I think, when it was formed in 1998, and I think I ended up chairing it from 2003 to 2005. And one of the, seemed like always one of the discussions at those meetings was, are the U.S. standards more prescriptive than the ISAs? I see John down there. I found ISA 220 to be interesting because I found that to be more prescriptive than the U.S. standards. But this is a big issue. And just how much guidance do we need to have there? And the second level would be sort of where we are today, and that is how much prescription should there be at the engagement team level? It seems to me as standard setters, there's three choices. One is to be very prescriptive, and that's provide very detailed guidance. The second choice, of course, is to be principle-based. And I guess there you would allow, you just have some very general principles in the standards and allow the firms to provide detailed guidance within their own firm methodologies. And I think the third position is some mix of the two. I think I know where I stand on that, but it's not my position to pick a side. With respect to today's two areas, and I guess the comments later on will follow those along. One, planning and supervision and performing the audit. Bella mentioned a minute ago that there is more detailed guidance on concurring partner in the standards, the interim standards. I've actually done some research in this area. Tom is familiar with this. I compared the guidance across the Big Four plus two of the other three firms, and not surprisingly, the guidance is pretty similar. What I'd like to do now is shift over to Mark's comments, and I'll probably interject some of my own as I read through his comments. But I think Mark has done a really nice job of providing what I think are some interesting insights, into this issue. And I'm going to read these so I don't misquote him, although I have taken the liberty of editing out a couple of sentences in this for brevity. As a former editor, I don't feel bad doing that. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to try and enhance the PCAOB-SEG's discussion regarding engagement team performance. Before expressing my views, I will note that although a number of colleagues have helped to shape my views, the views expressed here are entirely my own. In addition, if persons would like to know what conceptual model of financial statement auditing informs my view, I would refer them to the recent monograph, The 21st Century Public Company Audit, that I co-authored, meaning Mark, with Tim Bell of KPMG and Ira Solomon of Illinois. Now, on to my comments. First, despite the new prescriptive language regarding auditor rank that appears in ISA 220, my view, and I believe the prior consensus view among auditing professionals and market participants, was that that engagement partners have the ultimate responsibility for all the major audit tasks. So what's the news? There's little or no news, so I presume the purpose of the standard was other than to provide news. Perhaps it is to alter documentation requirements or to provide a better archive of conventional thinking. Second, once one starts moving away from principle-based standards and towards prescribing what auditors should perform, which auditors should perform an audit procedure, or which auditors should be prohibited from doing so, two things easily could happen. One, who performs or what comprises an audit becomes a bit more predictable. This potentially jeopardizes audit effectiveness. Second, individuals will change how they interpret standards. Observe the different phrases that the new ISA 220 uses to describe engagement partner responsibilities. I'm uncertain whether there are intended qualitative differences in the degree of responsibility or different involvement required by the engagement partner across these variations. And let me quote these to you. There's a number of sentences that say the engagement partner should, and then it goes on, take responsibility for, consider whether, form a conclusion, be satisfied that, and be responsible for. I'm not quite sure where that takes us. Third, that's my comment, by the way. Shifting gears a bit, one yardstick that I would encourage members of the SAG and the board to consider is whether and the extent to which contemplated prescriptions could have unintended consequences of substantially limiting the ability of an engagement team or engagement partner to undertake alternative compensatory approaches to ensuring high-quality planning and execution of audit procedures. Although there's not a perfect analogy, attending surgeons can engage in considerably more instruction and real-time monitoring when a green resident performs a surgical procedure than when a more experienced resident does so. Fourth, I want to emphasize that financial statement auditing to me largely is a professional judgment and decision-making journey rather than a prescribed set of cookbook procedures that are to be performed by specific members of an engagement team. I'm going to interject. I agree with that. As such, when identifying ways to ensure high-quality engagement team performance, I believe auditors should be advised to dutifully consider the set of risk factors that both cumulative wisdom from audit practice and theory consistent findings in the scholarly auditing literature suggest would impair professional judgment. To this end, I would encourage the SAG and the board members to explicitly consider auditors' requirements to be professionally skeptical. Engagement teams and engagement partners not only should be professionally skeptical of audit team management and audit evidence, but also of their own professional judgments, which happen to be fallible. I agree with that, too. That is, much like auditors must build a fudge factor for sampling risk when conducting sampling, they should circumspectively consider whether additional or different kinds of evidence is necessary in the light of professional judgment risk. I believe doing so would enhance quality control over specific financial statement auditing engagements. There is no empirical study that I can point to back up my belief, but 2 decades of auditing research has certainly identified a lot of shortcomings in auditor judgment. One consequence of this view is that rank-based and other prescriptions are not good substitutes for and may detract from the perceived need for the engagement partner, along with other members of the engagement team, an audit firm, to be skeptical of the quality of the engagement partners and other judgments in reaching key conclusions. Similarly, all engagement team members should ask hard questions about their own and other engagement members' capabilities, which may be lower than you might think. And this issue was raised in some of the prior discussions, and maybe we can come back to it later. With respect to this issue, the auditing literature has two messages. One is that auditors tend to be overly optimistic about their own and others' knowledge and or propensity to reach judgment errors. This holds for supervising auditors assessing subordinates with whom they frequently work. Among the existing studies on this topic is a paper that Mark co-authored with Jane Kennedy. He makes reference to a new paper that I've just finished that has a similar lesson. The basic point of those papers is that partners, managers, and seniors are overly optimistic of either the knowledge or the abilities of their subordinates. Now, that may not surprise you, but it's certainly empirical evidence. A second message is that for a couple of decades now, the auditing literature has noted that auditor rank is a noisy and imperfect measure and may provide a poor yardstick for assessing the extent to which auditor is likely to have sufficient knowledge and skills to plan and execute an audit procedure. The auditing literature underscores the advantages of using a family of cues to help assess auditor's capability and not just rank. One salient cue is the extent to which the auditor has industry-specific experience or specialization. And again, we've seen a number of research studies in the last 4 or 5 years that clearly indicate industry specialization is probably the key factor. I'll end with what I believe is the key variation of this idea. Prospective engagement partners often substantially differ in terms of their capabilities to be suitable engagement partners for a specific audit. ISA 220, it seems to me, is silent on this kind of variation in interpartner capabilities. Yet my understanding is that audit firm quality control teams help govern and at least sometimes effectively assign partners to specific engagements. I would recommend that any contemplated standard on engagement team performance avoid remaining silent on this issue. Those are my brief comments on today's topic. Thanks for the opportunity to try and contribute to your thinking. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill and Mark, for those comments. At this point, we are going to turn to our first topic of discussion, which deals with planning and supervision. We have two topics that we'd like to cover for the next about 30 minutes. One is, what is the level of involvement that the audit partner should have in the planning and supervision of the audit engagement? And two, should the auditing standards specify the audit partner's role in the planning of the audit, the staffing of the engagement, determining the proper level of supervision of less experienced engagement team members, or other aspects of the planning and supervision of the audit engagement? And now I will open up to the floor. Joe Carcello?
A couple of issues. The first issue, Bella, is does the board have any evidence that the standard's broken? You know, I think that's always a useful place to start. And is there any evidence from inspections that audit tasks are routinely being performed by the wrong person? It would seem to me if you have that evidence, then it's more compelling that this issue needs to be revisited. Without that evidence, I'm not exactly sure why you'd want to revisit the issue. The other thing I would throw out for consideration is my read of AS number 5 is that it provides greater discretion to auditors in using the work of others, regardless of the title of the person doing the work. Specifying required audit steps for audit partners and others seems to be moving in the opposite direction. And so it would seem to me that there's a fundamental inconsistency there that's probably worth thinking about.
John Morrissey?
Yeah, I guess I'll sort of anecdotally answer your first question, which was, is there any evidence to suggest that the wrong people are being assigned to tasks? In the prepare mode, you tend to see a lot of very junior auditors asking sometimes very difficult questions on very difficult areas. And you're always a little frustrated by their lack of experience, but that's sort of the nature of the game, and you go through the process and you work with them and educate them, because you know at some point that junior's person's work papers are going to be reviewed by a manager, and if it's a particularly sensitive area and they've done a good job of reviewing and documenting the discussion, it'll provide a good sound basis for the engagement partner to draw a conclusion as to whether or not what you've done is right. So, on the one hand, it's a yeah. There, you'd always like to see a more senior person doing the work, but the reality is, people got to get trained, they got to get educated, and you just kind of keep your fingers crossed that person comes back next year and is working on your engagement, and we already have a step ahead in terms of learning curve. But on the second notion here, do you really want to get in the business of dictating to the accounting firms exactly who's going to do what? If I put my auditor hat on, which I wore for many years, no two audit engagements are really staffed the same. Different partners have different skill sets, different managers have different skill sets, different staff people have different skill sets, and you need to be able to make reasoned adjustments to your staffing and assignment of tasks, and you need some flexibility. It's part of the fun of the profession is to be able to exercise professional judgment. And while the thought of, gee, let's have a nice framework for assignment of tasks and responsibilities, I would really be hesitant to start to micromanage how firms' staff engagements assign tasks to individual areas. I don't know if they really want to be in that business. I think having a good articulated framework for what the objectives are of a review, what the objectives are of an engagement partner or a manager in a particular area would be helpful. But to say that one individual's got to do this particular area or that particular area, I just think isn't very helpful at all.
Bob Kippers?
Val, I agree with Joe's comments and John's comments. I think the answer, though, to what you've got up on the screen there is what should the level of involvement be? I think it's whatever is sufficient in order that the partner maintain that overall responsibility for the outcome of the engagement. I think if you get any deeper than that, it's a slippery slope. When you were teeing this up, you mentioned the kind of the laundry list of things that are required for the concurring reviewer to look at. Unadjusted errors, all the key documents, the financial statements, the footnotes. Now, the audit standards don't actually say that the audit partner has to be comfortable with everything on that list before it goes to the concur. But I think it's pretty fundamental that would be the case. You can't concur in something that hasn't been first reviewed. And you think the partner has that as principal responsibility. Do we need the standard to say that? I don't know. If it's important, sure. But I think it's sort of intrinsic in the whole model. And I would not recommend specifying, particularly as you get from, think of the small engagement, partner, manager, senior accountant, one or two staff people. They probably all sit in the same room. And, to have specific requirements on that end of the market, and then you take the other end where we have engagements where there are over 100 partners involved in one audit. Now, if the partner can't do a certain amount of delegation, he's actually going to miss some of the more important issues that he or she's responsible for. So I think flexibility is the key.
Jeff Steinhoff?
I just want to echo what the first three have said here. I think they really got to the nexus of the issue. You have to lay out what the objective is and what the audit organization, whether it be one partner, 100 partners, what the audit organization is responsible for achieving, and how they go about achieving that is going to differ from engagement to engagement. And I think they have to ensure themselves that they've got competent people to carry out the various tasks that would be expected to do a professional job on a given audit. So I just want to agree with what was said before me.
Marty Hanisch?
I guess to
go back to the question that was raised maybe by Joe. I mean, is there a problem that needs to be fixed here? Is there evidence to suggest that there is inappropriate supervision, of the planning of an audit engagement? I mean, are you at liberty to discuss that?
We were actually looking for the SAG members to give us their input on that.
Well, I guess my perspective is based upon my experience with our audit team at Lilly is that I feel there's appropriate levels of engagement by the audit partner when that audit partner needs to be engaged. I think there's appropriate delegation to senior managers to plan the audit. But I have seen certainly a dynamic that has occurred, with respect to the integration of the substantive testing and internal control activity, with the advent of AS2 and AS5, that the audit partner certainly, and through the dynamics and the discussions that take place with us, at times gets, certainly more involved and has, shall we say, trumped the senior manager on certain aspects of the audit, which I think is appropriate, at least from the preparer's perspective, in an appropriate way. But I don't see, at least with respect to our engagement, where anything's broken, where I would suggest anything's broken.
Ted White?
I had exactly the same question as Joe, actually, which when I first read this was, in fact, right in the margin here says, is it broken? That's obviously a good question. I'm interested in the perspective of both the issuers as well as the practitioners. And then sort of a secondary observation is it appears to be fairly obvious that our approach to this is much more principle-based. And the sort of choice here is to move to a more rules-based approach to the international, which is kind of polar opposite to all of our broader discussions and other issues. And the other thing that occurred to me is that if this is broken, that does not really bode well for the much more complicated issues we're expecting a principle-based standards to address. To me, maybe I'm missing something, but this seems to me to be very common sense, straightforward, and if they can't use judgment to put the right people with the right set of experiences on the auditing tasks, then the far more complicated things that the principle-based approach is supposed to address are going to fail. So, it's a great question that Joe had, and I'm really interested in the bottom of that answer. Is if it's really broken, we've got big, big problems.
Ernie Baum? Can you turn on your mic?
Thank you. I'm not so sure that the standards we have are broken. I think what's missing is the required competencies for an individual to be an engagement partner. I think this was touched on in the comments, but I have seen instances where tax-only partners were designated as engagement partners, know very little about auditing the judgments that's required, and that's something that I think is just not acceptable, and it happens constantly.
Bob Tirola?
Thank you, Bill. It seems to me that this question runs to the business model of the auditing profession. And as it shifts to a more risk-based approach, from the prescriptive approach, it is going to require more judgment and generally judgment by more experienced people. As a consumer of auditing services, I don't think it's broken in the context that the job doesn't get done or doesn't get done well. But I do think that in order for the job to get done well in an AS5 world, there's much more experience needed to be brought to the engagement, with the trade-off, I hope, in cost being fewer inexperienced people. But that creates a major dilemma, I think. To the pyramid type business model that the firms mostly have, and would it need to narrow that pyramid in order to have specialists and other experts, more experienced people, involved with the work, given the judgments involved under the newer model?
Kaylin Hansen.
To
the question, is it broken? I don't think it's broken. If we wanted to give some guidance, I think that's one thing. But hopefully it would be flexible, principles-based, has been brought out. Scalability, certainly, the engagements that I'm on as opposed to what Bob has in his firm and the national firms are just different animals. The scaling is so different, but it's even so within my firm. I'm not sure that managers and seniors, we need to delineate what their responsibilities are versus partners. And I think Ernie brought up the question, just the general competency of partners and what that should be. I personally can't imagine that a tax partner would be signed as an audit engagement partner. I can't conceive of that type of situation. If that's happening, hopefully the inspectors are picking up on that. But there might be more pressure with the rotation requirements in some of the smaller firms to be putting individuals in those situations. I would imagine probably more in the concurring partner role than there would be in the engagement partner role. And then the other thing that I did want to mention is the concurring partner or the engagement quality review that we've been talking about. I really believe those standards need to be updated and gotten out. I do notice that the concurring partner review is really coming from the standpoint of a sort of negative assurance, if you will. Ultimately, the audit partner has to be responsible for everything, and they're signing that report. I believe that that's probably enough for me personally. That's enough guidance.
Harold Monk.
I would agree with what everyone has said so far, but I think we also have to be concerned that we not put something that might be counterproductive in the standards from the perspective that as we move into the risk, more of the risk-based approach, that it could influence the level of risk that is actually assessed in key areas and for relevant assertions for significant accounts. And based on who might be available on the team, push that risk assessment below where it otherwise might be so that more individuals on the team would be qualified to perform the procedures that are being anticipated. I don't know that anyone would intentionally do that, but I think there would be an influence inevitably in the planning process to consider those things.
Randy Fletchall.
Well, just a couple of observations. First of all, I don't think it's broken. In fact, I would say over the last 5 or 6 years, I think partner time and executive involvement in the audit has probably increased. I think, as Bill mentioned, we do all have our own guidance that we've built in for our engagements that give our partners direction as to where to spend the time, and I think it's to spend it in appropriate areas and particularly in the riskier areas. So I think we can have that part of it where it should be. Second, the one thing that does seem unusual, and I guess just to put it in context, is the fact that there's more specificity on what a concurring partner does than a lead partner. And just to remind everybody, that really stems out of the profession in another era, in self-regulation, deciding to add on its own an independent review partner, concurring partner role, and in doing so kind of spelled out what they thought was necessary. And so it does go beyond what was otherwise in the auditing standards for a lead partner. That's been carried forward into the board's interim rules, so it probably makes sense for those to get balanced somehow. It doesn't make a lot of sense to remain with much, much more specificity for an independent review partner, concurring partner, and a lead partner, but I don't think that means you need a whole lot of specificity to add on to what a lead partner needs to do. I think keep the principles, keep the judgment, and we'll be fine.
John Kellett.
Thank you. I first of all say that I agree with most, if not everything, that has already been said, and particularly Harold's point about risk-based approaches and the need to get appropriate judgment at the appropriate stages. And I agree with the comments about don't change standards if they're not broken. I think that is extremely important because as standard setters, we can sit around sometimes and think, well, what should we do next? We've got a bit of time. Let's do something more. And I think that can be can be extremely harmful, and I can wax at considerable length about the UK government's approach along those lines, but I shan't. I think that 2 points I want to make about our standards. One is that I don't think you should be left with the impression that they are terribly specific about what the audit partner needs to do. And the list of language that Bill read out at the beginning was, you'll note, was take responsibility for, form a conclusion about, be satisfied that. They were directing the engagement partner to those areas which specifically required the engagement partner's attention, and I don't think that's a bad thing. Secondly, in our case, when we revised the standard, our standards were broken in the sense that our quality control standard was a bit old-fashioned and also failed to distinguish between quality control at the level of the firm and quality control at the level of the engagement. So we had a specific job to do to split that out. And I think what we... second thing is that standards are a product of their time. And one of the things that we specifically wished to do was to make sure that appropriate people were looking at appropriate issues, both within an engagement and at the firm level. And, for example, when one looks at the quality control standard for a firm, a lot of emphasis is put on the fact that quality must be something that is the responsibility of someone who is sufficiently senior. And, in fact, quality within the firm, that is, it really rests at chief executive, managing partner level, or his or her delegatee, but at the appropriate level within the firm. So that sort of concept was introduced. And other matters such as the assessment of engagement partners for audit ought to put quality above business development, for example. Now, how you demonstrate these matters is perhaps difficult, but I think a few years ago you would probably all agree that sort of message was an important message which had to be got through the profession. So I think there's more to the standards than the simple question of responsibilities of the engagement part. And I think in revising our standard, the relevant responsibilities within firms was something that was extremely important at the time the standard was written.
Thank you.